All right, this slide you saw last week is our title slide as we were heading into Deuteronomy chapter 27 and 28, as well as 29, are going to be speaking of the two mountains, Gerizim on the left and Ebal here on the right, upon which you'd have six tribes each soon after they cross over the Jordan, who will antiphonally, is a fancy word that just means in a back and forth, are going to be making a commitment, taking an oath to obey the law. So last week I pointed out then that this is the Mount of Blessings that are being spoken on Gerizim on the left, and then the Mount of Curses, or Cursings, as it's come to be called, is Ebal there on the right. However, what I didn't take the time to do last week, got a little more time here this evening, is to mention that this is the heart, not quite the capital, but really still the heart of what is the region that we know as that of the Samaritans. So you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar comes in after Assyria, 200 years apart, and then the Jews are completely conquered at 606, 597, and then again in 586. Nebuchadnezzar's really mopping the floors with them and destroys the temple. They're taken off into a 70-year captivity, which was prophesied by Jeremiah. More on that tonight, as we'll see these things being prophesied well in advance by Moses now on these two mountains. But then there will always be some who can sneak off into the woods, you know, and hide themselves. And eventually there will be a return and some intermarrying that by the time of Jesus and the apostles in our New Testament times has resulted in this new race and society of Samaritans. And so Nablus, I mentioned last week, is the modern city that's in the saddle between these two mountains. But that is ancient Shechem, which of course has a terrible history there. Jacob's daughter Dinah is raped there by Hamor's son, and you know, we just have all kinds of unhappiness that takes place. But that is going to become preeminent location for a lot of Bible history. Jacob's well is just out of sight right over here off to the right. All of this plains region, which you can now see if you were standing on Gerizim and looking out this way, you would have this view right here. This is magnificent country, very, very fertile, grow anything, you know, that you like. And Jacob is spreading out into this region himself. Shechem is this town. Samaria, the one you can see right here, Samaria is in the distance now off to the left, but not very far at all. And that, of course, is going to become the chief city, the capital city for the Samaritans. So named after a region that's named after a mountain are the people, the Samaritans. But on Mount Gerizim, originally, they had been worshiping down here at the foot of this mountain. And in Jacob's well, John chapter 4, what happens? The woman at the well. What does she ask Jesus? You people say, worship on what mountain? Where Jerusalem is. We say, she's a Samaritan, we say, see, it's this mountain. To this day, there are those carrying on that tradition, though they are extremely few, nearly completely extinct, who are still sacrificing goats up here on this mountain that you see here in the foreground. And so just a tremendously important region in Bible history and a number of events that take place. Today, it's what they call the Palestinian Authority or Palestinian land. You can visit there, and I have been kind of through there, but I've never seen these two mountains. I've never been in this immediate area here. It is not something I would do on my own. If you had a good guide, you know, and felt comfortable with him, I think I'd be willing to go in there. But obviously, it's a little more tense and behind those lines. So one last thought is we're thinking again about Moses in chapters 27, 28, 29, preparing the people to come here and give their thanks dead center in the promised land. Is to show you just this artist's rendition of a man named David Roberts. That was April 17th of 1839. As a matter of fact, he dates all his pictures. And so this is Jacob's well here with Gerizim there, and then here's the valley and Mount Ebal over here. The reason I thought I'd show you this, though, is just to see that it's amazing the archaeological work that's been done throughout this country of Israel since 1967. The new, entirely secular, not has got a thing in the world to do with the Bible, group of people who today are calling themselves Jews or Israelis, became a nation in 1948. So they just celebrated their 70th year as something very, very different than what the Bible has, but nonetheless, some remote ties. And notice, though, that there's all these ruins back here, various columns that are standing or fallen, but no structures. Starting in 1967, and after the Six-Day War then, Israel's just gone crazy with trying to resurrect these sites. The Palestinians have not done so well, though there is some work that they've done. In the Palestinian territories, hardly any archaeological work has been done. But throughout that, which the Israelis themselves are controlling, a site like that would just be candy. And so they dig, and reveal these various cities. So this is the setting. I'm not going to have any more slides tonight. We're going to pick up with chapter 27, just to see where we were last week. As this section begins, Moses and the elders of Israel charged the people, saying, "Keep all the commandments which I command you today. So it shall be on the day when you shall cross the Jordan to the land which Yahweh your God gives you. You shall set up yourself large stones, coat them with lime, write on them all the words of this law when you cross over, in order that you may enter the land which Yahweh your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, promised you." Are the lights flashing, or is that just me? Are you guys seeing lights flashing? Okay. I've got some kind of big flicker going on. I think it must be these lights up here, or this rather dim light right here. I'm not sure which. So now I worry nobody else saw it. It was distracting. So we'll see if that continues. At any rate, keep these commandments. You're entering into this land flowing with milk and honey. And I want you to write this on these upright stones. And so probably for just generation after generation to come, I showed you photographs in Egypt last week where they have 2,000 and 3,000-year-old inscriptions similar to this. Then, in my opinion, chapters 27, 28, and 29 would have been carved into this lime that had been coated like stucco onto the stones. Inscriptions then that would have lasted for a very, very long time. This is just a profoundly important moment in the Jews' history. They're about to cross the Jordan. They're about to enter this land. They are vowing before God to keep His law, and God is informing them in no uncertain terms both the blessings and the curses that'll come their way if they do or fail to obey these commandments. The curses began in verse 15 of 27. You can see 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, all the way down to the last verse of the chapter are curses. And then in 28, where we got into last week, verse 1, "It shall be, if you will diligently obey Yahweh your God, being careful to do all His commandments which I command you today, the Lord will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you." So verse 3, verse 4, verse 5, verse 6, blessed, blessed, blessed. These are developed more fully, these blessings, than the previous curses were. And then we come back again to the cursings. So a lot more time is spent on God telling them how bad it is going to be if you won't serve me. These warnings, these threats, I ended the class with at verse 48 last week by saying, "Aren't you glad this class is over?" You remember that? Why did I say that? Because the material was so horribly grim. It just is graphically describing terrible things that will and did befall these people. Well, you ain't seen nothing yet. Because the worst of it, and by my lights at least, the much worse of it, far more graphic, far more frank, is about to come our way. So we're in the midst of the second group of cursings when we ended up at verse 48 last week. Let us begin then with chapter 28, verse 49 tonight. Yahweh will bring a nation against you from afar, from the end of the earth, as the eagle swoops down, a nation whose language you shall not understand, a nation of fierce countenance, who shall have no respect for the old, nor show favor to the young. Moreover, it shall eat the offspring of your herd and the produce of your ground until you are destroyed, who also leaves you no grain, new wine or oil, nor the increase of your herd or the young of your flock until they have caused you to perish. And it shall besiege you in all your towns until your high and fortified walls in which you trusted come down throughout your land. And it shall besiege you in all your towns throughout your land which Yahweh your God has given you. Then, now here it comes. This nation's coming. It's coming fast. It has no mercy. 53. Then you shall eat the offspring of your own body, the flesh of your sons and your daughters, whom Yahweh your God has given you during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you. The man who is refined and very delicate among you shall be hostile toward his brother, toward the wife he cherishes, and toward the rest of his children who remain, so that he will not give one of them any of the flesh of his children which he shall eat, since he has nothing left during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in all your towns. The refined and delicate woman among you, who would not venture to set the sole of her foot on the ground for delicateness and refinement, shall be hostile toward the husband she cherishes, and toward her son and daughter, and toward her afterbirth, which issues from between her legs, and toward her children whom she bears, for she shall eat them, pardon me, secretly, for lack of anything else, during the siege and the distress by which your enemy shall oppress you in your towns. Was it bad last week? Now, there are times, brethren, in our Bibles where God gets so direct that it is just very uncomfortable, isn't it? Now, you can imagine here are all these tribes that have just come into their promised land. You got six on one hill, you got six on the other. They're shouting back and forth, you know, amen, we're going to do this. You know, but you get to these cursings. This is the material that's going to be carved on those stones. This is the material that they're going to be vowing to. They knew exactly what they were in for. And this will be fulfilled, of course, ultimately in Nebuchadnezzar. Now, it is certainly true that the people that will become the Samaritans don't exist right now. I mean, the people will become Samaritans in generations to come. And Assyria is going to be chief in that. They will conquer the northern part of the ten tribes in 722 B.C. So the Samaritans will all come out of that. But it's my conviction, I think most, that here in this chapter, what he's talking about here, though, is the subsequent siege of Nebuchadnezzar, which then destroyed the city, sent him into 70 years captivity. Assyria was bad. And hard to describe how bad, in fact, but this probably is the even more thorough destruction of Nebuchadnezzar. Pardon me again. Okay, so see how well I can do for the rest of this. But what I'm trying to say is, you know, I don't even want to read verse 57 again. It's just too awful. And these are the things that were fulfilled. These are the things that are going to be prophesied by a number of other prophets. These are the things that Jeremiah is referencing when he says it's going to be a 70-year captivity. And shortly, as bad as all this sounds, we're going to find out it's not permanent. It's not the end. There is always hope and always opportunity for you to come back, God tells these people, and they did. And Jeremiah knew they would. It would take 70 years. When they came back, there'd be a whole new nation living in the north of these Samaritans that they were going to, you know, have problems with. And so on and on it went. But this prophecy, brethren, is one of your more specific, those, you know, also simultaneously disgusting and revolting, you know, kinds of prophecies. Because when God gets mad, then God's going to give you the belt. And he's going to see to it that nobody misunderstands. Nobody is going to take it lightly. Nobody's going to think they're so tough that they can handle it. More on that specifically in a little while. When God, you know, gives you the prophesied information about the future that awaits you, you can sure enough believe it. And so it got that bad. Now, ultimately, because I already used ultimately once, so ultimately, however that would go, to do it twice, the Jews will be completely destroyed, never to be seen again in 70 AD, and all the same terminology is used for all these various destructions. So it's tempting to say, well, this might be referring to 70 AD, but in a moment we're going to find out there will be a return, and so certainly it is not. But it got this bad. So what he's trying to say now, those people that you would consider the most sophisticated, the wealthiest and most powerful, those that are the most refined, went to all the best schools, you know, and all of that, people who, you know, have the finest manners and, you know, polite that you could ever imagine, you know, been to all those finishing schools, those people will be fighting each other in their families to cannibalize their own children. That's just hard to even imagine. And then it happened. It happened again, and Josephus describes it, in 70 AD. You would think it's impossible. What happened with the Donner Party? Okay, recently I saw a two-hour, recently it was months ago, but you know, I watched a two-hour video documentary on the Donner Party. I heard about it all my life. I knew there had been some cannibalism and everything, but I happened to get caught up in it. And it was just an astonishing, amazing story, how they were forced to resort to cannibalism. And people were eating not just friends, but relatives. And you say on a full belly, I'd never. And all you say then is, I don't have a clue. Because everybody that's ever become a cannibal in such circumstances had said, I'd never. But you know, everything goes out the window when you've been starving under a siege and starving and starving and starving. And so these curses, you would think, would sink, as the expression goes, deeply into their ears. And I suppose they did. For some years. Okay? But would the people be able to pass that down to their children? Near as I can tell in world history, brethren, it's just not possible. The first generation or two that starts something new begins as our country did, you know, 1776, let's pick that Declaration of Independence year. And, you know, those people are willing to sacrifice their lives, you know, and their property and their sacred honor, as it was so famously said. And they did. And so they loved our Constitution. They loved the nation. They fought and bled and died for the nation. But as generation after generation comes along, does that same spirit, that same kind of depth of patriotism, can you sustain it? You just can't. And so we fault so often, I know I have frequently, these Jews and just scratch our heads. How in the world could they not, you know, have remained faithful? But brethren, Adam and Eve couldn't do it. And you haven't done it. And I haven't done it. And nobody in between's done it. It's just the way the world works. So we all do our best. We hope that we can establish our own family dynasty and keep generation after generation, at least in our family, you know, would be faithful. But even that is rare. When you meet third and fourth generation Christians, it's amazing. Wow, how about that? because it is just so rare. So I guess maybe we shouldn't get so up on our high horses, you know, about how we would have done different or how they should have done different. They heard it from Moses' mouth. They heard it from a miracle worker who, you know, could part the sea, and as long as his arms stayed up, you know, then they could win the battle, and you know, all those things that so many of them had seen. But brethren, it isn't inherited. Every single generation has to start over again. Every individual has to decide for themselves if they're going to be faithful. It's every generation, a new generation, to find out if people will be faithful to their God. And likewise, then the gospel's in season, the gospel's out of season. We come to Christianity, and it's been exactly the same thing, you know, ever since. So we learn the lesson and dig in deeper and, you know, harder, and do the best we can to commit ourselves to serving our God. Because as soon as you think it can't happen here, then what does history tell you? It happened right there every time. So now we come to 58. We're in 28:58. If you are not careful to observe all the words of this law which are written in this book, to fear this honored and awesome name, Yahweh your God. Now for our visitor's sake, you hear me say Yahweh, you're looking at your Bible, you're seeing Lord. Any time in most Bibles now, it's become a convention, that you have Lord in all capital letters, it's telling you that the word itself is most likely pronounced Yahweh. I don't think Jehovah really gets to it, but Yahweh, and that is the personal name of God, and that is being distinguished from Molech or Astarte or, you know, greatest Diana of the Ephesians, whoever it might be. So I've gotten in the habit myself, just personally, when I see that in my Bible, I go ahead and use the personal name, so you understand at least, you know, why you see that difference there. So in 59, Yahweh will bring extraordinary plagues on you and your descendants. Now, brethren, the like is not, that's because the descendants themselves were sinful, though sometimes your children suffer pretty bad for your mistakes. So you sin, the invading nation comes, they don't pick out all the children and say you're not going to suffer because of the parents' sins. You are going to suffer. You're not charged with their sins, but you can still suffer because of their sins. And now it says in the middle of 59, even severe and lasting plagues and miserable and chronic illness. He will bring back on you all the diseases of Egypt of which you were afraid, and they shall cling to you. Also every sickness and every plague which, not written in the book of this law, Yahweh will bring on you until you are destroyed. Then you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitude, because you did not obey Yahweh your God. Now here, what that sounds like to me is, you know, I, God, am going to invent new diseases for you if you will not serve me. Now I'm sure all these diseases were always available, but God is ensuring it's going to be the worst of the worst. So we think about various plagues that we have going on, you know, in the Center for Disease Control and the various World Health Organization and so many others, you know, trying to combat what's the latest thing is measles now, I guess, you know, is back again with a vengeance. And so these things that we have technologically had so much power over, does that mean that we could ever put an end to disease entirely? I don't think that's even possible. Now, this prophecy is not about the United States, but the principles still have always been so. God is in charge of the nations. He said so in the book of Daniel. And Nebuchadnezzar learned it the hard way, eating grass himself and growing his nails out. And so that man finally repented and confessed. You know, he was not so great as he thought he was. But this is true for each and every single nation that's ever been. God is still ruling in the kingdoms of men. He still uses things like this to try to turn them back to him. It is only when you've lost everything that you then really can feel the fullest force of desire to seek help from a divinity rather than from science or from politicians who will fail you most of the time, it seems. And so these warnings come in various forms. And sickness is only the most recent one in verses 58 through 62. So you remember, of course, that when they had been promised that God would not put any of the diseases of Egypt upon them if they would serve him. Now he's saying, I will put those diseases on you if you fail me in any particular generation. And so every sickness you can imagine until you're destroyed, 62, then you shall be left few in number, whereas you were as the stars of heaven for multitude, because you did not obey Yahweh your God. Now, next section, 63 to the end of chapter 28, so six verses down through 68. And it shall come about that as Yahweh delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so Yahweh will delight over you to make you perish and destroy you, and you shall be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. Now, let me take just a minute here, with 63. When you read the first half of that, 63rd verse, it creates an image that I think we all fully understand and we all appreciate. So read just the first half. It'll come about that as Yahweh delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you, what? Now comes the second half. Now, obviously, we think, well, the first one, that's only right and fair and appropriate. God's delighted when his children behave. Now we've got God's delighted when they don't. Delighted how? What do you think he means? I don't think God ever takes pleasure in it, but if there's an emotional involvement, and there is, God is expressing it in terms of intensity, in terms of passion. So to the extent or degree that I delighted in you when you do well, I will have the same passion. We've just been reading it in these curses when you don't. Now, I'm not sure if you'd want to add this next passage, and I haven't got the exact verses, so I'm going to have to go back and look. But you might want to jot in the margin there next to that 63rd verse. Let me just read a lengthy section from the very first chapter of Proverbs, from Proverbs chapter 1. It's going to be verses 24 through 33. So if you'd like to jot that in a margin there, it's a similar idea. Now, in Proverbs, wisdom is being personified, and we need to remember that. It's not actually God saying, I'm going to do this. He says wisdom's going to do this. It's fair to say that God is the ultimate in all wisdom, though, so that what is represented here is wise in God's eyes. It is right then for God to practice it himself. So here's 24 through 33, the last verses of Proverbs 1. Because I called and you refused, I stretched out my hand and no one paid attention, and you neglected all my counsel and did not want my reproof. Verse 26, I will even laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your dread comes. When your dread comes like a storm and your calamity comes on like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come on you, then they'll call on me, but I will not answer. They'll seek me diligently, but they shall not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of Yahweh. They would not accept my counsel. They spurned all my reproof. So they shall eat of the fruit of their own way and be satiated with their own devices. For the waywardness of the naive shall kill them, and the complacency of fools shall destroy them. But he who listens to me shall live securely and shall be at ease from the dread of evil. It's very similar here to Deuteronomy, isn't it? And now wisdom, God himself talking about delighting in a thing. Remember, he himself counsels also in the book of Proverbs that you're not to rejoice when your enemy falls, lest God see it and turn his wrath away from the man that's being punished. So you always have to be careful in all of this. But at the same time, God is passionate about this, and I don't know any place in Scripture where it is more fully on display than in chapters 27 and 28 of Deuteronomy. That's why these chapters on the blessings and the curses have become very famous. It's one of the first things that people associate with the book of Deuteronomy. Oh, Gerizim and Ebal. They're going to stand up there with their own voices, hear these words. They're going to inscribe them up there on Mount Ebal, where they'll have the altar that Joshua's going to build. We're going to have these vows that we're taking, shouting back and forth across the valley. These things God reveals. And if you don't serve him, he will afflict you and then mock at you, laugh at you when you suddenly, you know, want help. Well, my car's on fire. You know, I'm trapped underneath. Dear God, if you'll save me, I'll become a good, faithful Christian. Ha! You had your chance. Sure, now you're going to serve me. Sure, now you want me to help you. Well, I can't hear that prayer. God says in Proverbs. He's saying exactly the same thing here. 63, it shall come about that as Yahweh delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, he was happy to do that, so Yahweh will be happy over you to make you perish and destroy you. You shall be torn from the land where you are entering to possess it. Moreover, Yahweh will scatter you among all the peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And there you shall serve other gods, wood and stone which you or your fathers have not known. And among those nations you shall find no rest. There shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there Yahweh will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, despair of soul, so your life shall hang in doubt before you. You shall be in dread night and day, shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you shall say, would that it were evening. And at evening you shall say, would that it were morning. Because of the dread of your heart which you dread, for the sight of your eyes which you shall see, and Yahweh will bring you back to Egypt in ships, by the way about which I spoke to you, you will never see it again. There you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there shall be no buyer. Oh. That 28th chapter comes to an end. God is saying, you don't serve me, you will not maintain this land. You'll wind up back in Egypt just like your forefathers said they wanted. And you'll be in such bad shape there, you can't even sell yourself to be a slave. That's the starvation passages that we've also been reading. I think Saber had a hand up there. Real loud, Saber.
Is there no repentance or redemption? It doesn't sound like it.
Not in this chapter. It's in the next chapter. 29 now in verse 1. See, it got overwhelming, didn't it? I mean, you can just feel the weight of it. And here we are, we're just reading about it. And I can tell Saber's just breaking her heart. You know, you just, can there be no hope? Well, let's read about it. 29:1. These are the words of the covenant which Yahweh commanded Moses to make with the sons of Israel in the land of Moab, besides the covenant which he had made with them at Horeb. So now we're going to get the summary statements about the blessings and curses that are to be shouted back and forth between Gerizim and Ebal and inscribed in the lime of the altar on Ebal. So verse 2, Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, You have seen all that Yahweh did before your eyes in the land of Egypt to Pharaoh and all his servants and all his land. Now that's going to be everybody between the ages of, you know, about 50 and 60 would be able to remember it and have been under the age of 20. So he says in 3, the great trials which your eyes have seen, those great signs and wonders. Yet, to this day, Yahweh has not given you a heart to know, nor eyes to see, nor ears to hear. And I've led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes have not worn out on you. Your sandal has not worn out on your foot. You've not eaten bread, nor have you drunk wine or strong drink, in order that you might know that I am Yahweh your God. When you reached this place, Sihon the king of Heshbon and Og the king of Bashan came out to meet us for battle, but we defeated them. We took their land, gave it as an inheritance to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of the Manassites. So keep the words of the covenant to do them, that you may prosper in all you do. Now, let's get back to verse 4 for just a minute. This always creates a problem. I think it's just simply, idiomatic expression that the Hebrews would understand fully, but we get kind of universalist in our thinking, you know, and so we have problems with this. Right in your margin, or after the verse 4, Matthew 13, verses 10 through 17. Matthew 13:10-17. Now there's several others. Mark has this recorded as well, but I'm just going to read this one. Matthew 10:13-17 reads like this. What did I do wrong here? I'm sorry. Matthew 13:10-17. Did I say it wrong? I don't know if I did or not. Matthew 13:10-17. That's what I was saying, 10 maybe, but it's 10 through 17 on the verses. So here we go. All right. Behold, I'm reading chapter 12. I'm telling you, I'm in good shape tonight. 13:10. The disciples came and said to him, "Why do you speak to them in parables?" He answered and said to them, "To you it has been granted to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been granted. For whoever has, to him shall more be given. Your having was up to you." If you have, that's because you love the truth, you sought after God, you hungered and thirsted after righteousness. Whoever has, to him shall more be given. He shall have an abundance. But whoever does not have, and that's your fault, I'm adding, even what he has shall be taken away from him. Therefore, in other words, that's why I speak to them in parables, because while seeing, they do not see. While hearing, they do not hear, nor do they understand. So they're not hearing, they're not understanding, but whose fault is it? It's their fault, for sure. I'm going to read some more in a minute. But frequently God would say, he did it with Pharaoh for instance, "I harden Pharaoh's heart." Well then, Pharaoh's innocent, right? No. Pharaoh's guilty as he can get. How did God harden Pharaoh's heart? By giving him miraculous signs that should have softened his heart. But in the face of that overwhelming evidence, ultimately 10 plagues and then the parting of the Red Sea, Pharaoh refused every single time. So who sent the plagues? God did. So God says, "I have not given you the heart." What's the problem? He gave them everything so that they could make that decision. But they chose not to. So when God looks at it from his standpoint, "I gave you all those miracles, but I couldn't give you the heart. No matter what I did, I couldn't give you the heart." But it's still their fault. Okay, he tried. Now, just to read on. In their case, the prophecy of Isaiah is being fulfilled, which says, you will keep on hearing but will not understand. You'll keep on seeing but will not perceive. The heart of this people has become dull. With their ears they scarcely hear, and they've closed their eyes. They're charged with it. They've closed their eyes, lest they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and return, and I should heal them. So it's just an idiomatic expression that kind of throws us for a loop, but it made perfect sense to these Jews and these Hebrews. So, you know, it's not predestination, it's things that people have made out of this. It's hand in glove, God giving you the evidence, you have to make the decision. Now, back to Deuteronomy. The other expression that needs explanation, I think, is in verse 6. You have not eaten bread. Okay. Nor have you drunk wine or strong drink. Well, that sounds bad, doesn't it? When you think that's bad? In order that you might know that I am Yahweh your God. How would they're not eating bread and not drinking wine or strong drink cause them to go, there's a God? Any ideas?
He said the manna.
Yeah, they didn't eat bread, they ate manna. It was a miracle. And then they didn't eat the or drink the wine or the strong drink. What's that going to relate to? What did they drink?
Water
right out of a rock. Another miracle. Well, they would get it. He just said, you saw all these things. Your sandals didn't wear out. You know, he's recalling the wilderness, which so many of them couldn't remember. So, that reads weirdly to us, you know, like I deprived you of something and that you might know I'm Yahweh. But he's actually referencing the miracle that should have caused him to know he was the Lord. When you reach verse 7, this place, Sihon, king of Heshbon, see, all these things are miracles I did to cause you to respond to me. Now, 10 through 13. You stand today, all of you, before Yahweh your God, your chiefs, your tribes, your elders, and your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and the alien who is within your camps. They had Gentiles with them every foot of the way. There are Egyptians that left with them. From the one who chops your wood to the one who draws your water, verse 12 now, that you may enter into the covenant with Yahweh your God and into his oath, which Yahweh your God is making with you today, in order that he may establish you today as his people, that he may be your God, just as he spoke to you and as he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, brother, you know, we so often we think, well, I wish I'd been there for this event. I wish I'd heard the Sermon on the Mount. I wish I'd seen this, or I wish I'd seen that. I got to tell you, I wish I'd been here for this one. Can you imagine Moses 120 years old? All that he's been through. They're 40 years fresh out of the wilderness. Down on the plains of Moab. Nebo's up above him, and Moses already told him, I'm going to go up there and die here pretty soon, and it's your fault. And it was. They tempted him at that very rock. And so, you know, the passion that must have gone into this, the intensity of the verbiage, they're swearing they're going to do it. And then I wish I could have crossed that dry bed of the Jordan and climbed up on Gerizim or Ebal, depending on which one of the tribes I was in, and shouted back and forth, you know, these things. Wouldn't that have been something? Wouldn't that just bind these people together? Wouldn't you be saying, I'm going to come down off this hill and serve my God in this promised land? I'm going to fight the Perizzites and the Hittites and the Amorites and every other right there is. We're going to clear this land flowing with milk and honey. Let's go to war. How very invigorating these two events must have been, shortly, you know, apart from each other. One just before Moses dies, one just after. Now in 14. Now, not with you alone am I making this covenant and this oath. But both with those who stand here with us today in the presence of Yahweh your God, and with those who are not here with us today, that you may know how we lived in the land of Egypt, how we came through the midst of the nations through which you passed. Now, I understand that expression, and again, a little obscure to us, but I think what he's saying is to all your descendants after you, and you're going to keep telling them about these days and this covenant. Now, to continue, in verse 17 through 21. Moreover, you have seen their abominations and their idols of wood, stone, silver, and gold, which they had with them. Lest there should be among you a man or a woman, a family or tribe, whose heart turns away today from Yahweh your God to serve, go and serve the gods of those nations, lest there shall be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. It shall be, when he hears the words of this curse, that he will boast, saying, I have peace, though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart, in order to destroy the watered land with the dry. Now, God is now going to address anybody who thinks they can discount what they've just heard and go into that land and misbehave in the arrogance and thinks they can get away with it. He wants now to single that attitude out, the rebellious attitude. In verse 20, he continues, Yahweh will never be willing to forgive him, but rather the anger of Yahweh and his jealousy will burn against that man, and every curse which is written in this book will rest on him, and Yahweh will blot out his name from under heaven. Then Yahweh will single him out for adversity from all the tribes of Israel, according to all the curses of the covenant which are written in the book of the law. 22. Now, the generation to come, your sons who rise up after you, and the foreigner who comes from a distant land, when they see the plagues of the land and the diseases with which Yahweh has afflicted it, will say, all its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown and unproductive, and no grass grows in it, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admon, Zeboiim. Did you know there were four cities that were destroyed, not just the two? Which Yahweh overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. 24. And all the nations shall say. Now, brother, before we read any further, I really hope one of the big takeaways you'll get from this class on Deuteronomy is now how often, and going back to the fourth chapter, that God has repeatedly said, not in so many words, but in this verbiage here, you Jews are the light of the world. All the nations are going to be watching you. When they see you serve me, they see the superiority of my law, they see the blessings I shower upon you, they will glorify me. And when they see me destroy you, they'll still say it's because those people wouldn't serve Yahweh. They're going to see what I do to you, for good or for ill, blessing or curse. So in 24, all the nations shall say, why has Yahweh done thus to this land? Why this great outburst of anger? I mean, after all, they're eating their own children. Then 25, men shall say, because they forsook the covenant of Yahweh, the God of their fathers, which he had made with them when he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Remember, Sihon and Og had heard about those plagues. And they went and served other gods in 26, worshiped them, gods whom they've not known, whom he had not allotted to them. Therefore the anger of Yahweh burned against that land to bring upon it every curse which is written in this book. And Yahweh uprooted them from their land in anger and in fury and in great wrath and cast them into another land, as it is this day. The secret things belong to Yahweh our God, but the things revealed belong to us and to our sons forever, that we may observe all the words of this law. Now, you know, that's one of my all-time favorite Old Testament passages. I've quoted it several dozen times in the 7 years I've been preaching for you. That's the first time, though, that I've shown it to you in its context. Now you know. It's the end of the blessings and curses statements. It's the end of this proclamation, you know, about how these people should behave. It is the high point about all the nations are going to be watching you to see whether it's good or ill, depending on how you serve me. So the great grand crescendo, you know, the big grand finale is, I haven't told you everything. There are secret things that belong only to God. But what I've just told you in these last three chapters, you will live to see generation after generation after generation. So what is he trying to say to these people? Teach your children to serve me, because you will be able to watch in real time what happens when you do and when you don't. The secret things are mine, God says. But what is revealed is a lot. And so far in the second telling of the law, we've had 29 chapters. And he specifically said, not just what was said over there on Horeb, but, you know, Sinai, but also everything that I'm writing now. This is the one covenant. And so, this is just so shockingly drawing these people up to make their decision. Just as Joshua will say, choose you what? This day, whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve Yahweh. Thus they did. So, brethren, this is just such grand material, isn't it? It's just grand stuff. Deuteronomy, much neglected book. Nah, it's just the second telling of the law, and I didn't enjoy the first one. You know, it's the way most people feel. Oh, brethren, it's just, you're missing so much. This is, again, I've striven to try and bring it out for you. This is just one of the most passionate books in your whole Bible. Moses just pouring out his heart, pleading, threatening. Moses rehearsing the history. Moses in his last breaths, because he knows he's soon to die, one last climb up Nebo, is doing everything in his power as moved by the Holy Spirit to impress these people with the responsibility they have to serve their God. I'm telling you, it moved them then. For how long? About one generation. That's all you could ever get out of it. Okay, comment or question? Yes.
On the hardening of heart, if you go back to when Cain and Abel offered sacrifices on the altar, and Abel's was accepted and Cain's was rejected, and God says, why is your countenance fallen? All you have to do is do what's right. But he hardened his heart against God and against his brother. And it's a perfect example of why they understood.
Yeah, you're showing how the same material has these opposite, you know, reactions in Cain and Abel. And it is a great illustration. Not now to use a biblical one, but one I think has been very helpful and enlightening for me is the old expression, the same sun that hardens the clay, you know the rest of that expression, melts the butter. But it's the same sun. So the point is, that sun will have wildly different, you know, reactions, like Cain and Abel, wildly different reactions, opposite reactions, based on what?
The
heart, based on the substance that it's working with, based on that raw material. The raw material and its responsibility is up to... That's up to us. Are we going to be sand or rocks? Are we going to be clay or butter? What are we going to be? Faithful or not? We have to choose this day, every day. Great illustration. Class is missed.